Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Second Opinion. The subject for this episode is the new biology. Biology is the study of life. Human biology is definitively studied. DNA, cells, and the immune system are among the most fundamental parts of the human form. The body is a battleground for external particles and microorganisms, and health relies on protection in the form of vaccines, pharmaceutical drugs, and suppression of symptoms. However, some see human biology in a different way and claim humans have no DNA, cells, or immune system. They claim the germ theory of disease is unproven and the answer to sickness and health lies not in the body protecting itself from foreign invaders, but in cleaning up the terrain of the body. They emphasize personal responsibility for health and wellness. The key role of water in the body is a central theme of the new biology. Here to discuss these issues with me is Dr. Andrew Kaufman, a medical doctor, natural healing consultant, inventor, public speaker, forensic psychiatrist and expert witness. Dr. Kaufman completed psychiatric training at Duke University Medical Center after graduating from the Medical University of South Carolina. Dr. Kaufman has conducted and published original research. Kaufman also ran a startup company to develop a medical device he invented and patented. It's nice to talk to you again, Andy. When we talked last time, one of the subjects we covered, of course, was COVID. And in this interview, I'm really interested to look at the psychology and the religion behind the COVID hoax and the germ theory, which is such a fixed belief for the vast majority of people. And I know you have obviously a background in psychiatry, so I'm kind of interested to pick your brains and what is it that makes people just believe what they're told and refuse to question and refuse to think outside their box of beliefs?
Right. Well, there are several factors involved here. So one is we could call indoctrination, and another we could call a mass formation or mass manipulation or mass psychology. So the indoctrination, which is largely rooted in the compulsory schooling system, but it includes early experiences, because we have all adopted this as the dominant, cultural paradigm. In other words, that we give away our authority or our decision-making ability or our conclusions to an authority figure, right? So the first authority figure is the parent. And for example, I was just talking about this last evening, that the realization that the fairy tales of Santa Claus, for example, and the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny, the stories that we tell children, and then later on tell them, oh, we lied to them about it, right? So it's kind of like we're saying we're the authority figure, and no matter what you think or believe is true, we'll tell you what's really going on. And then that is really played up in school, right, where the information itself comes from the authority figure, right? It's the textbook that writes the definitive information, or the teacher that tells you this is the way it is, or even the principal or the dean, right, in other realms telling you this is the way it is. Like they have those, we call them assemblies, but where you gather all the students together and, tell them something about the way things are in the world, right? Like, and it could be about drugs or pregnancy or all kinds of things that are for the purpose of societal manipulation. So there are many other factors about the compulsory schooling, and I think I encourage the listeners to look into John Taylor Gatto, who is a famous teacher, actually won many awards in teaching, but was very critical of the compulsory schooling system. And he talked about, for example, the length of time that you're allowed to study a certain subject, that it's always a set time limit, like 45 minutes or an hour. And then the bell rings. It's saying that whatever you're doing, whatever you're learning about, or whatever you're creating, it's not as important as herding everyone from one room to the next room, right? That takes precedent. And so it sort of limits your individual expression and puts the collective, right, or the whole group of students in the school, their welfare ahead of your own. And that's the cultural philosophy that underpins a lot of the propaganda claims used to enforce or manipulate people into cooperating with, you know, measures that remove their independent freedoms and liberties.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we saw that during COVID. Everything was about the other.
That's right.
The person next to you, the people next to you, the people you're going to meet when you go out and about. It's not about you.
Exactly. And that collectivist philosophy, where the good of the collective is supersedes in importance the good of the individual, that is the philosophy that's behind all totalitarian control societies. And in some circles, it's almost synonymous with communism, but there are many different terms applied, you know, to these control systems, and they might have slightly different politics and financial systems underneath them, but they all involve this collectivist philosophy, which is something extremely dangerous, but it's been creeping in to, you know, the common psyche, and now almost seems to be the dominant modality in individualism, which, you know, is what our nation, the United States, was founded upon, really, is just melting and fading away.
So what is it that makes medical professionals, doctors, virologists, scientists not question what they're told? Is it the more extreme version of what you just said? Or, I mean, you know, obviously there are those who do have some suspicions that what they're doing is wrong, but they think about the bottom line of, you know, being able to pay the rent. But the vast majority of them, it would seem, believe the narrative.
I'm not sure if it's more extreme. I mean, it certainly is a continuation of that, right? I mean, in general, people don't question anything that is right, generally told to them by the sources which are considered authorities, which, you know, includes the government, designated experts from the government or from academic circles, you know, and various other international organizations that are held, you know, with this authoritarian status. So they are susceptible to that. And in fact, through the medical training, there is even more indoctrination, or I would even call it hazing. And of course, I can only speak about how this goes in the United States, but I've heard similar stories from other places that you're essentially, you know, overworked, you're given massive amounts of information to memorize, and it just consumes all of your efforts. In their entirety, like to the point of sleep deprivation, that you just have to do what you're told, like, you know, study for the exams, score high enough, impress people, don't piss off anyone by not knowing the answer to a question. And then once you get into practice, it's like you start out with all of this debt. Or even if you don't start out with it, as soon as you're finally making money, the tendency is to buy a bunch of things like a car, a house, et cetera, right? And buy those things on debt. So then you have to keep working to service the debt, and you get into the same kind of, you know, slave mentality that virtually everyone else who's working gets into. And then you're faced with a situation that if you realize the truth of what you're doing, that you're actually harming people, and that even what you were taught is not true, well, then that puts you in the position where you have to leave that job or that career.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? You have all of this debt obligation that you won't be able to service, right? You don't know another way to do things or how to remake yourself. And then, you know, even the consequences in your personal life. So there's many, many strong, you know, incentives preventing you from questioning or taking seriously what you observe before your very eyes, because every doctor who pays attention sees that their patients don't get better. In fact, I was told a little anecdotal story by someone just recently who was an individual with kidney failure and was on dialysis, like regular dialysis, go to a center, and was taking all these medications, you know, prescribed by the nephrologist and his regular doctors. And he just decided on his own one day, after watching some YouTube videos, that he was going to follow this herbalist. And he got off all of his pharmaceuticals and was taking herbs and maybe made some other changes. But essentially, the only medical treatment that he was doing in the mainstream was the dialysis, which is, you know, a procedure that kind of compensates for the kidney not doing its job. And his doctor, who got like regular blood work and stuff, said, "Hey, what are you doing? All your blood work is improved."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Well, I stopped taking the medicines you gave me and followed this herbalist." And he showed him the guy's videos, and the doctor said, "Well, just keep doing that. It's working." Right. And so that doctor, that's really as far as he could go. He could say to that individual who found this on his own and showed improvement to keep doing that. But if he decided to take the next logical step, which would be, "Oh my God, that's incredible. Let me learn why this is working. Let me look into this herbalist teacher and see what he has to say. And then I'm going to integrate that into what I do."
Yeah.
Now that you can't take that step.
No.
Because then you'll be fired from your job.
Yeah.
You'll lose your license.
Well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you'll be in bad shape, even though you'll be actually be helping people that you were previously harming. So it's very difficult for individuals in that system to leave. And that's exactly why I have an apprentice program to work with doctors specifically and teach them how to have a career in natural healing where they can do a lot of good for people and still make a living.
It was this goes back to the American Medical Association, doesn't it? Towards the end of the 19th century, which basically the sequence of events involving that led to allopathic medicine being the only medicine that you can prescribe even, and you have to have a license. And if you operate outside of that, then...
I'm glad you brought that up, because it emphasizes the point I was making earlier about compulsory schooling, because the way that happened was through an infiltration of medical education. So you're right, it was the American Medical Association that was heavily involved in partnership with Rockefellers and some of the other robber barons. And they created a document called the Flexner Report, which was really critical of other types of medical practice, which, by the way, were the predominant practice in the United States, up until the 20th century, like things like homeopathy and naturopathy were the predominant kinds of doctors. There were allopathic doctors in the 19th century, and you know what they were prescribing is medications, quote unquote, made from arsenic and mercury.
Yeah.
And they would even give those to teething babies. They would give mercury tablets until they became distressed, like with nausea and vomiting or diarrhea. And then they would have less teething problems. So, they weren't very popular because they weren't very successful. And this way that they co-opted the medical education system by coming up with an accreditation body that would essentially only accredit allopathic institutions. And then this was coordinated with developing pharmaceuticals from petroleum, which the earliest pharmaceuticals were derived from, and still many, many are today. I actually have a short documentary project on this that was a collaboration with Steve Falconer. If you just put in andrewkaufmanmd.com and then /HIPPO, H-I-P-P-O, it'll go right to that page.
So to mention COVID again, one of the things I did want to talk to you about was
the COVID vaccine, or fake vaccine as I call it, because it doesn't stop transmission or infection, continues to be rolled out. and cause life-changing and life-ending consequences for people worldwide on an unprecedented scale. I see that one of your colleagues, Stefan Scoglio, has done some great work investigating the spike protein in the fake vaccine.
Yes, Stefano Scoglio has done some really excellent work, and I actually added that presentation of his to my library because it was so important. Let me just make a minor correction. So the reason why these injections don't affect infection or transmission is because there is no infection and there is no transmission.
Yes.
So that's not exactly what Stefano is saying. What he's saying is that there's no evidence that anyone who's injected makes the spike protein in their body. And this is really an odd thing, because the whole point of developing an mRNA or gene therapy technology is that you're trying to get a host organism, right, whoever you're going to give the injection to make a foreign substance, a foreign protein usually. Yeah. And that mRNA, you know, message is the code for that protein. So in order to know that you've successfully done that, the first thing you'd want to do is test for that protein in the animals that you injected, right? Yeah. Even with the basic animal studies, and then repeat the same thing when you test it in humans, if you get that far. And in fact, if you apply for FDA approval for a gene therapy, it's required that you test all the bodily excretion fluids for the substance. So you test the stool, the urine, the sweat, the saliva, and the blood. And when it comes to the spike protein, there are actually some very standard ways to detect it and measure it that are much less controversial. So now, some of them don't even require antibodies, which is what Stefano was talking about. Right. But you can buy a kit commercially to do this. Now, what we've seen is almost no studies that even look for the spike protein at all. So the drug companies that manufacture these technologies have not put out any data or studies or published anything. There's one very small study from Canada where they did a really strange assay, and in a very, very tiny group of people who just got the product from Moderna. And they claim they found spike protein, but it hasn't been repeated. And it really is strange the way that they were doing that. And then the only other evidence, which is what Stefano was talking about directly, was from autopsy studies where they used an antibody stain that would supposedly like make spike protein visible, because there was an antibody that would bind spike protein, and then it had a, you know, color added to it, or fluorescence, and you could see it under the microscope. Now, what Stefano was talking about, and, you know, he speaks from direct experience working with antibodies in the laboratory, and I've done this as well, although not in the same way, that, you know, antibodies are not nearly so specific like we yeah. think they are. They bind many, many things. Like, for example, the HIV antibody test that has never been FDA approved, but it's still in common usage, it's been shown to be positive in over 60 other health conditions. That antibody just binds with many, many other things besides whatever the target, you know, quote unquote HIV protein is, which is, it's not from HIV, but there's something that it was binding with, you know, in the original experiment. So in using this kind of an antibody, which hasn't been demonstrated to be specific and only, you know, that will only bind with a spike protein and not other proteins, it's essentially meaningless to look at this, because we don't know what this stain is really binding to. And there have been, you know, lots of mistaken identities, because there's no confirmation where they use chemical analyses. That's really the only way to know what's what, is by doing, you know, analytical chemistry on a sample, and then showing, you know, the results of that.
And there's also the reproducibility crisis, isn't there, with antibodies?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's for the same reason. And that's a crisis in all of science.
Just two more points, and then we'll get on to something which I'm very interested to talk to you about. First of all, Stefan Lanka's control experiment. Any idea when that will be published? Because I know people would want.
Well, I mean, it's already been published. Will it ever be in a peer-reviewed journal? I doubt it.
No.
You know, part of the reason is
where could people read it? Is there a place people can go online to read the study?
I know there is. I think it's probably in Lanka's newsletter publication. He has a journal, got a German name, so I can't recall exactly what it is right now, but many of the articles are translated into different languages, and I can connect you with the person who can give you access to that. I mean, I have it. It's in several of my presentations, the slides that are created from his study. But let me also mention that there I know of two published peer-reviewed studies on viruses that had control experiments, and both of them were positive and disproved this virology method. And John Enders, which is the original paper that this isolation procedure was described, but there's also the original monkeypox paper where they isolated monkeypox. And of course, I only looked into this because it seemed like they were trying to drum up a monkeypox pox pandemic. And in that study, essentially what happened was there was a laboratory that was studying vaccines, and they bought some monkeys from Africa, I believe, and several weeks after the monkeys arrived, some of them developed skin lesions and got a little bit sick. And so they did virus isolation experiments and claimed to find a monkeypox virus. But then they did it on another group of animals that were in the same shipment that were not sick at all. And they also had the same exact results in the experiment. So that was the control group, and it disproved, of course, the method and invalidated it, but that's not how they reported it in the paper, unfortunately.
And there was another example situation, I think it was in Japan, called the SMON virus scandal, where they thought they isolated a virus, they thought they'd taken photographs of it and shown infection, when actually it turned out that the symptoms were caused by a drug, clearquinol. And not a virus. And so
there's just so much confusion about cause and effect among modern medical science. So in that situation, you know, when our cells are damaged by any kind of insult, they break down into small particles. And those particles are what the scientists point to under the microscope and call viruses, but they're actually the end result. And you can show these particles in any illness, and they just pick some and say that they're a virus because they, you know, have other reasons why they suspect it's a virus. But you could do this in any, you know, this led to the war on cancer, which was a major United States government research funding program in the 70s. That was hunting for viruses causing cancer, because you could look at cancer cells under the microscope and see the cells breaking down and see these particles. And if you believe that they're the cause, then you can go on a snipe hunt, and that's what happened. And of course, it turned up no fruit because these particles have nothing to do with causing cancer.
Well, we see the same in kidney biopsies. There's papers written on that where they found particles, and they pointed out how the particles that have been said to be other kinds of virus particles look identical.
Yeah, so this was from Kidney 360, and these samples, of course, predated COVID. And what was unique, because if you look at any diseased tissue under the microscope, you're going to find particles. But in this case, the particles they found in these kidney biopsies had the so-called, spikes on them, that are given as proof of a coronavirus, that it has this spike protein. But in this case, they said, no, there's nothing to do with viruses. In fact, they even said what the protein was that these spikes so-called allegedly were made of, that it was a human protein and not a spike protein. So, of course, looking at these pictures tells you nothing about the origin of what you're looking at. You have to do additional experiments. You know, when you see these images from the electron microscope, you're not even looking at biological tissue. You're actually looking just at heavy metal stains. All of the microscope can't see proteins and DNA and lipids. It can only see heavy metals. So, you know, it's you have to take it with a grain of salt, exactly what you're seeing, but you certainly can't just point and declare, oh, that's, you know, this or that's that. You have to do other experiments to say what those things are.
Do we know why the particles have spikes? Because we're told it's how the virus enters the cell and replicates. So if they're not virus particles, it's not because of that. So is it known why they have spikes and where the spikes come from, or is it just...
So if you start looking at damaged tissue and cells from cell cultures under the microscope, you're going to see a large variety of different sizes and morphology of particles. And you're going to see lots of them that have look like they have various things on them. But what I'm trying to say is that if they look that way in this microscope picture, it doesn't really tell you anything about what's going on inside the body. Yeah. So, I mean, and this is not just related to what I was talking about heavy metal stains. Anytime you take a snapshot photograph of something that's dead, okay, because in modern biology and medicine, they only look at dead tissue taken out of a body or taken from a petri dish under the microscope. They don't observe living things where they can see behavior. So in other words, no one has seen a particle go and enter a cell, you know, and interact with certain receptors or anything like that. This is mostly discovered from experiments done artificially in the lab and from computer simulations. But when you have a snapshot, like for example, let's say that you are, you have your hand in your pocket and you're right outside the front door of your house, and I take a snapshot of that. In explaining what you're doing, are you putting your key back in your pocket after locking the door on your way out? Or are you reaching to get your key out to open the door on your way in? You can't tell from a snapshot, right? You need to have a series of snapshots, right? Or a video or direct observation of what you did before and after that moment in time. But we don't have this kind of evidence at all for these alleged particles that are sometimes referred to erroneously as viruses. So all of these stories about that it does this or that or the other thing, they're all from inference and indirect evidence and from in vitro experiments, where they study something in a laboratory, not actually in a living organism like it happens in nature. And we have to be extremely cautious, because this kind of evidence doesn't tell us about what's going on in nature. You know, for example, if you want to study cells in a culture, like a tissue culture, and this is what they use for these virus experiments, the cells of mammals, like in our body, think about what's going on in our body. We have all of these processes that are keeping us alive and functioning. So if you take a cell in your liver or your kidney, it's got blood constantly coming in and bringing all kinds of things to it. It brings nutrients, it brings sources of energy, it brings signals from hormones, it brings white blood cells that are looking for foreign substances or waste materials to remove, right? All of this kind of systems are taking care of all of the cells in our body. Now, if we take those kidney cells out of the body and put them in a tissue culture flask in a laboratory, well, we don't have a way to simulate the circulatory system and the immune system and the endocrine system to take care of those cells in a lab. So we have to do other things to keep them alive. And so one thing is that we genetically modify them, or we use fetal cells, which tend to stay alive much more readily. they have this kind of amazing survival potential, like a fountain of youth, which is why they're developed into a lot of, you know, health products. And so it's very artificial conditions, adding fetal products, genetically modifying the cells to survive better, you know, mixing in various chemicals and, you know, tweaking things. So when you have this kind of soup where you're barely keeping these cells alive in a laboratory culture, and then you do experiments on those cells, how much can you really learn about what happens inside, you know, the living human, where you have all of these other systems coordinating together to bring out the function and to deal with threats?
So we're told that cores, or, you know, the particles, they cool, virus particles, you know, invade the cell and replicate and leave. So I assume that that's never been visualized then under an electron microscope. They've never actually seen a virus particle, or what they call a virus particle, do that.
Right. Well, you know, of course not, because of that from still photographs. Now, of course, we know that cells do break apart into a million little pieces. And that's called apoptosis.
Yeah.
In fact, that is, you can think about it as like that cell has basically outlived its usefulness and has become trash. And breaking apart is just separating it into trash bags rather than just dumping all the trash out in the middle of your body. Right. And we do this, of course, when we put out our own trash. You know, we put it in bags. We don't just dump it on the street. And so you could think about that. That is what's happening. And that has been observed under the microscope. But the thing is, they've never done the experiment where they had a pure virus and they mixed it with cells, and then all the cells started exploding like that. That would actually tell us something important, but that's never been done. So that you can observe cells being damaged. You can observe cells with particles, and you can see these particles both inside the cell. You could see them on the cell membrane or the boundary of the cell, and then you could see them outside the cell in various, you know, pictures. But there's no observation of them moving one way or the other. And they probably, you know, it's well described in a basic biology book that there's exocytosis and endocytosis. And that's when exocytosis is when the cell excretes things, and they're often in membranes, right? Because they're like invaginated by the membrane in the surface of the cell, and it's just pinched off as they leave. And you can find these diagrams in all kinds of books because this has been actually observed. And the same thing, that it can take in things from the extracellular space and bring them into the cell, endocytosis.
So exosomes, which of course you kind of, I guess, probably brought to public attention more than anyone, they would be an example of that.
Well, exosomes are just one alleged type of this particle that results as cells are damaged and dying. Now, they actually have a broader category, which they just call extracellular vesicles. So that means, you know, just little particles outside the cell. And we don't, you know, fully understand what these things do, although there have been some interesting experiments showing various function. But these are real things. And in experiments, they can actually go right to an organism and purify these, you know, exosomes out of biological fluids like blood. For example, there's a really fascinating study looking at AIDS or HIV, quote, patients, because they actually took exosomes out of the blood of HIV patients, and they were able to purify those exosomes and then do a chemical analysis, like tell you exactly what they're made of. Now, at the same time, they could have just done the same exact thing with the alleged HIV particles, but of course they didn't. They just relied on like antibody and PCR tests to say that HIV was there. Now, why hasn't anyone ever purified HIV particles out of the blood like they do with exosomes? And the reason is because there is no HIV.
Yeah. Okay, so now I want to move on to water and how important water is
And I find this utterly fascinating. And I know both you and Dr. Tom Cowan have done a lot of work on this subject, and it all plays into what's called the new biology, of course, of people who are new to that. So for people who are new to the new biology, can you first of all explain that, and then why water is more than just a liquid in our body?
Sure. The new biology is what, you know, a term that I and some others use to basically describe rethinking of the science of biology using the actual scientific method and using good discernment and logic and reasoning, because many of the conclusions and theories which were created based upon these kind of pseudoscientific or false experiments, simulating things with computers, doing these in vitro lab experiments and assuming that it tells you true things about what's happening inside of an organism. And so although we describe it as new, some of this knowledge actually goes back to ancient wisdom before it was corrupted by the modern materialist science and molecular genetics and things like that. And it turns out that, but let me also say that what we talk about is passes muster as being rigorous in the scientific method. So, you know, if there's something that is just hypothetical or conjecture, I always make sure to note that. But with water, we have some very hard scientific experiments and observations that tell us that what we've always been told about water, that it's just a passive substance in the background and it just dissolves everything, and then the other molecules actually do all the work, like the proteins and minerals, etc. So it turns out that that's really not the case at all, and that water actually has these amazing properties that are really only recently have been introduced into the scientific body of knowledge, and they're still on the fringe, although clearly there are very, very solid experiments that have been done and repeated that clearly show these properties, for example. So what I'm talking about is that when water is in your body, it actually turns into a very different substance than what we're used to as, you know, the liquid, solid, gas model, you know, water, vapor, or steam, obviously water, the liquid, which we could call bulk water, and then ice in the solid form. And we already know water has some unique properties. Like, for example, in the solid form, it's less dense than the liquid form. And all other, virtually all other substances are more dense when they're in the solid form. And this is why ice floats in your glass. And it's also why melting ice caps would never cause a sea level rise. They would cause the sea level to decrease, because the liquid is more dense, so it takes up less mass or less space, and it would cause the sea level to go down, not to rise. It would rise if we added more ice. But this basic fact escapes common logic. But that's one clue about water, that it's very, very different. And other things change about water, actually, as it gets near the freezing point, to its density actually goes down before it goes up. So you can look at that separately. But this other type of water that forms in your body has been referred to as the fourth phase of water, structured water, easy water, or liquid crystal water, or gel water. So it's got many, many names, but it really is a crystalline type of structure, but still has some properties of liquid. For example, it can still flow, but it has a much higher resistance to flow, or viscosity. And it turns out that this water forms into this gel-like structure when two things happen. And there might be other ways this happens as well, but in a biological system, there are two factors. One is the water is near what's called a hydrophilic or water-loving surface, which is really all of the inside of your blood vessels and the other surfaces, you know, in your body where water is next to, including the proteins inside your cells. And the second thing is a source of energy, which really comes from infrared light, which originates from the sun, but objects, both organic and inorganic, absorb this infrared energy, and then they radiate it or reflect it back. So even at nighttime when it's pitch black, you're always being exposed to infrared light. And that's the basis of night vision goggles. So this infrared light provides the energy to the water, and then the hydrophilic surface allows it to form this gel-like liquid crystal structure. And this special phase of water has unique properties. For example, it can actually hold a charge. Like, it can form a battery and cause charge separation. And this has even been used to turn on a light bulb. So this happens in every cell in your body. We're told that there's a resting membrane potential, which means that every cell has a voltage and is like a mini battery that could generate electric current. And we know that cells have to have this voltage to survive. And when we see, for example, cancer cells that are dying, they have a lower voltage. And when we look at dead cells, they have a zero voltage. So there needs to be life for this to happen, but this water gets structured in this way, creates this voltage through charge separation, and this is an extremely active element of our biology and chemistry. And now it's been clearly shown that ATP is not the source of the energy that maintains our cells' batteries. It's actually just the water. And Gerald Pollack has done an experiment using the cell walls of algae as a hydrophilic surface and made little cells and put different minerals inside and outside the cell, but without any mitochondria to produce energy, and was able to show that a resting membrane potential occurred just with the water, without any need, for this other source of energy. So water really, in my opinion, plays the central role in biology because it makes up 99 out of every 100 molecules. And I didn't even talk about the other things it does besides this electrical potential, but there are many other functions because it can take this energy from the infrared light and actually transduce it into other forms of energy, like we talked about transforming it into electrical energy, but it can also be transformed into chemical energy, into physical or motion energy, and a few others. It can even radiate light back out.
How does that work?
Well, I mean, I don't know that we know exactly how it works, but we can measure the response that when that water can take in this energy from the infrared light, and then it can put it out in all of these ways. And this has been demonstrated in a variety of experiments, like, for example, what's called capillary action is one of the mechanical functions that can occur from this. And if you put a tube made of a hydrophilic material inside a beaker of water and expose it to infrared light, which means that just put it anywhere, what you'll see begins to happen is that water flows through that tube spontaneously with no other inputs. This is all because of inside the surface of the tube, near the surface, it forms this easy water, and then there's a charge separation. So you get like a kind of a tunnel that has a negative charge, and then in the middle, there's like a pipe with positive charges, and those charges repel each other and generate flow through the tube. And they pop, those positively charged water ions out one end of the tube, and the other end sucks in neutral water. But then, of course, that becomes charged through the same process and keeps the flow going. And this flow through the tube will continue indefinitely. Like, you just walk away from that beaker, leave it there as long as you want, and it'll just keep flowing forever. Unless you completely shield it from the infrared light source. then it will stop.
So do you see the medicine healing of the future being based on water, founded on water, rather than a lot of what it is today, which is founded on false biology and the immune system and et cetera?
Well, it will certainly be about water if I'm able to influence the future paradigm. But already in my teaching, this is the main theme. So all of the procedures, essentially, which I've seen result in amazing health outcomes, like people completely resolving, you know, serious chronic health conditions, like things like autism, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, heart disease, diabetes, etc. They all involve rehabilitating the body's water.
So I have to jump in on the point about autism there.
Yes.
People, you know, he's saying that autism could be cured. How does that work?
Well, I mean, I think if you want to look at that, the best thing to do is look at Carrie Rivera's material, because she's the one who's had the largest number of success stories working with children and teenagers with autism. But I can tell you, you know, what I'm getting at theoretically is that that illness is really a result of the water in your body is unable to form this fourth phase liquid crystal structure. And there are experiments that show that when you put toxic substances in with water, that the size of this crystal, where they call it the EZ zone, diminishes. And there's even experiments like with numbing medicine that's used for like dental procedures and, you know, and for the skin for simple surgical procedures like a biopsy, that in a dose dependent manner, it shrinks the size of the EZ. And that's what disables your sensory nerves from being able to function and detect the pain. So that's why you're numb. And so you could imagine that when water is contaminated with toxins and it diminishes its ability to form this liquid crystal, and then the voltage goes down and the function diminishes. So there's a variety of ways that you can help your body to do this, but your body's always trying to purify this water. And this problem can occur both when there's not enough water, which means that all of the contaminants are become concentrated and have more of an effect, or when there's simply too many contaminants that are interfering with the water's ability to do this. And the most natural and simplest way for your body to rehabilitate and purify its water so it could regain this function is through water fasting. And where simply you only put water in your body, you rest as much as possible, and your body essentially does its own self-healing where it purifies out this water. And what you find when you do this is that you actually can drink quite a bit of water to help your body recycle it, because it seems to put out the water that's contaminated out of your body through, you know, through your urine, initially through your bowels to some degree. And then you can keep replenishing it and end up drinking. You know, when I fasted last time, I drank 6.5 liters of water a day by the end of the fast, because that's what my body needed to really rebalance and rehab all the water. And now that's not the way that other people like Carrie Rivera use different approaches, but I believe that the same thing is happening within your body, that it's just purifying different contaminants out of the water, that certain contaminants are more toxic, for example, to the nervous system and cause problems like autism, and other contaminants might be more toxic to the blood vessels or the kidneys, and then there's individual differences.
I was going to ask you what you thought about the statement that that ideally we drink 8 liters of water a day, and I guess you know that when you said you Drank 6.5. I guess you're kind of on the way to that.
Well, so, you know, I don't think we need 8 liters a day. Actually, have done a lot of in-depth research, and, you know, there is no real answer that's established through research. And also, it doesn't make sense that there's one fixed amount for everyone, because we're not only are our bodies different in size, shape, and composition, but we also have very different behaviors. So if you, for example, if you're training for a marathon and you're running for 2 hours a day and you're sweating a ton and losing a lot of water that way, right? And so you're going to need a lot more water than someone who is working in an office and, you know, just goes from their house to the car, from the car to the office and back and, you know, is not sweating or doing intense activity. So I've actually developed educational and other materials, including a protocol of how anyone in 30 days can rehydrate themselves and also find out how to know how much water they actually need. We've lost our ability to know when we're thirsty. Now we confuse dehydration with thirst. So in other words, it's not until we become dehydrated that we think we're thirsty. And so we're always behind the eight ball, catching up from being dehydrated to trying to rehydrate ourselves. We're never fully hydrated and re-engaged with our thirst mechanism so that we know how to listen to our body and drink sufficiently in order to meet our needs in a more natural way.
Okay, so as we bring this to an end now, following on from that, I know you're currently running an alchemical detox course, and through the website, and I guess that water plays a fundamental role in that. What is an alchemical detox?
Well, great question, and yes, there is a lot of curriculum in there does involve this water information, and including the hydration protocol. So detoxification is your body's natural mechanism to remove waste products and poisons from the environment. And, you know, back when we were just in a natural environment, there weren't that many poisons. But our industries, you know, the chemical industry, pharmaceutical, energy, et cetera, have just created incredible amounts of poisons that are ubiquitous, and we're exposed to them from every angle. Our bodies have a really hard time keeping up. And what, you know, the detoxification is basically how do we support our body to eliminate these things? And also, how do we educate ourselves so we can stop exposing ourselves to these things in as much as we can, right? Like, we still have to breathe the air that's outside, but inside of our house, we can actually filter the air, because there are a lot of things inside our home which we have control over, which are poisoning us through inhalation. Like, for example, if you buy new furniture or carpeting that is made of petroleum products and plastics, when those are new, they off-gas all kinds of plasticizing chemicals, solvents, you know, coatings, a variety of substances, and we breathe those things in. And many times, you know, people get an acute illness because their body has to detox and express those things out of the body, so that you develop a cold or diarrhea or things like that. So what I'm teaching is how you can support those body detoxification mechanisms to help yourself heal from problems, and also to prevent your body's need to go through an acute cleansing reaction, like having a cold or other type of acute illness. Now, the alchemical part is that alchemy is this ancient wisdom and science that most of the mainstream scholars that we learn about in school actually were scholars of the alchemical sciences as well. People like Isaac Newton, for example. And the alchemical formulation is a way of conceptualizing nature through elements and transformational processes. So, you know, we're all familiar with the four earthly elements of air, fire, water, and earth, which is, you know, the all the substance, and then of course the ether being the fifth element. And so you can understand the body, right? Because we know that the body is mostly made of water, but has earth. So it's a combination of water and earth elements. And that's pretty simple and self-explanatory. There's also this transformational process that in nature, right, there's always change and transformation. For example, if we eat an apple, right, before we crunch and swallow that apple, right, it's a round-shaped object. It has a red skin, a stem, et cetera, et cetera. Once we chew and swallow that up, we actually turn it into something else. We separate different parts of it. Some of them we turn into poop, right? Other parts of it we turn into human flesh. It studies real transformations in nature, like I described, that occur all the time if we open our eyes and see them. And it describes various steps in that transformational process. And when I learned about this and thought about the healing that people go through, I realized that they're actually going through these steps. And so I use this to help formulate different aspects of the healing process through detoxification. And some of the steps, by the way, don't involve anything physical. They involve what I call psycho-spiritual. So recognizing and dealing with how your trauma has influences your behavior and your health. Recognize the addictions that you have, because we all have addictions. In fact, they're part of that indoctrination that we talked about earlier, creating food addictions or addictions to shopping or to, you know, various things involving devices like gaming and social media. So, you know, those are part of this transformation process. If you ignore those aspects and just do something physical, then you might have some short-term improvement, but you're going to end up back in the same place you were, right? Because you didn't do all of the steps to bring about a real lasting transformation. You only brought about a temporary, reversible, small change. And so it's been a very powerful tool to help recognize, you know, the need for all of the steps, and then also how some steps may not be super pleasant. Like, for example, the step of calcination or the burning away of the, you know, the bad elements, right? That can be very unpleasant. And a great example that our bodies do this spontaneously is a fever, right? A fever that we experience, which helps us heal and actually purge toxins, is one of these alchemical steps of calcination. But we know that when we experience a fever, we feel horrible. And that is probably necessary for learning that what have we done to bring about the need for this fever? That's, you know, because it makes us feel so bad. Maybe we should go back and change something that we do so our body won't have to keep giving us this message.
Every time I talk with you, I feel like I want to do another interview again straight away after. So just to wrap up, so you've got the alchemical detox course, you've got the water course. So just let people know where they can find that and what other projects you've got coming up that you're working on.
Yeah, well, I just also did another workshop on heavy metal detoxification, and I've introduced a couple of new products, Zeo Focus Zeolite and Clarity Bentonite Clay, and those combined with my other products make up essentially the four essential elements for heavy metal detoxification. So that's also available now for people who want to learn more, or if that's causing you a health problem, I actually teach you how to recognize if heavy metals might be causing you a health problem, so you know if it's something that you should consider addressing in your health journey. But I'm always focused on developing new education and teaching and trying to spread this message, and also, you know, inspire people to just take a look at health and biology and recognize that all the pills that they're taking are not really making improvements in their life, and that there is a way to bring this about. So I partnered with Marcy Cravat to make a documentary to introduce this kind of material to the larger audience, called Terrain the Film. You can find it at terrainthefilm.com. But much to our shock, and we're about to make a big announcement about this, it's now available on a major international streaming service, on Amazon Prime. Wow. So this is a, you know, a major opportunity to spread this word, like, because you can tell your friends and family, oh, you know, hey, this, you know, I've been really looking into this alternative health research, and now this guy, you know, he has a film about it. You know, you might want to check it out, because the whole reason that I delayed writing a book and started with a film is because films are popular and they're easy to look at, right? It's like people don't have the attention span to read a book. I know that if I wrote a book, only very serious people who already know about this issue would read it. But yeah, everyone loves watching movies. So, you know, this is a great opportunity to check this out, you know, from any hotel room, any home, virtually the world over. And it's in multiple languages as well. So I'm hopeful that a lot of new folks are going to be inspired and start to look into the kind of information that I'm talking about.
Brilliant. Thank you, Dr. Andrew Kaufman. Enjoyable as ever and informative, and I hope we can speak again soon.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Daniel.
Thank you. Bye.